Hey there. Real quick, before we jump in, this deep dive is brought to you by CERT Fuel. If you're gearing up to the Series 66, they've got a full course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams that are weighted exactly like the real thing. It's basically your secret weapon. So definitely check them out at CERTFuel.com. All right, let's get into it.
Yeah, let's dive in.
So imagine buying into a top-tier mutual fund, right? It's November, you put in your hard-earned cash, and almost immediately, the broader market takes a slight dip.
Happens all the time.
Exactly. By December, your shares are actually worth less than what you paid for them. You are literally sitting on a loss.
Which is painful enough.
Right. But then you open your mail and find a massive tax bill from the IRS for like thousands of dollars in capital gains related to that exact same fund. Profits you never saw. Profits you never made.
Oh, man.
It sounds completely illegal, right? Like a clerical error or a total scam, but... Yeah. It's not. It happens every single December, and it is entirely by design. So today, we are decoding the hidden mechanics of pooled investments so you understand exactly why that happens and how to prevent it.
Yeah, that phantom tax bill is one of the rudest awakenings a new investor can face. And if you are studying for the Series 66, I mean, understanding the architecture that creates that tax bill is non-negotiable.
Completely.
You likely already know the basic definitions of mutual funds and ETFs. You know what they are. Our focus today is entirely on how they function out in the wild under extreme stress and, you know, over long periods of time. We're going to look at the internal fee structures, the liquidity constraints, the tax traps, and the pricing algorithms.
And most importantly, we're going to look at how to match these specific mechanical structures to specific messy human beings without committing a regulatory violation. Because the Series 66 is fundamentally an exam about suitability.
Right. It's not a vocab test.
Exactly. It doesn't just want to know if you can recite a definition. It wants to know if you can apply a complex financial vehicle to a client's specific psychological and financial profile.
Which is the actual job of an advisor.
Yeah. So to do that, we need some crash test dummies.
Yeah.
Throughout this deep dive, we are going to run our concepts through three recurring fictional characters. I want you, the listener, to picture them right now. First, we have cautious Carl.
Oh, Carl.
Yeah. Carl is terrified of losing money. He hates fees with a burning passion. He actually has a very long-term time horizon. He's investing for a retirement that is 20 years away, but he panics at the slightest market dip and constantly wants to check his balances.
That is a psychological profile that literally every financial advisor encounters within their first week on the job.
Yep.
The long horizon mathematically dictates one strategy, but his emotional fragility demands another.
Exactly. Next, we have impulsive Irene. Irene wants massive returns, and she wanted them yesterday. She day trades constantly. She completely ignores long-term costs because she only thinks about the present moment, and she always, always needs immediate access to her cash.
High energy, high risk, zero patience.
Spot on. If a vehicle locks up her money, she will lose her mind. The suitability challenge with Irene is basically protecting her from her own friction costs.
She'll trade herself into poverty if you let her.
She really will.
Uh-huh.
And finally, we have wealthy Walter. Walter has a massive bankroll. Because he has so much capital to deploy, he qualifies for almost every volume discount the financial industry offers. But there is a catch.
There's always a catch.
Walter is completely oblivious to tax consequences. And frankly, he's terrible at math. He will step over a dollar to pick up a dime if you don't guide him. So, cautious Carl, impulsive Irene, and wealthy Walter. We're going to throw them into the pooled investment waters and see who sinks and who swims.
It's the perfect framework. Matching the right pooled vehicle, and specifically the right share class to Carl, Irene, or Walter, is the absolute core of your suitability obligation as an investment advisor representative.
Let's start with the big picture, the buffet of benefits and risks. We need to establish why these structures even exist in the first place. If wealthy Walter has $2 million in cash, why wouldn't he just open a brokerage account and buy 500 individual stocks himself?
Right.
I mean, we live in an era of zero commission trading. He could just build his own personal S&P 500, one share at a time.
Well, the barrier isn't necessarily the trading commissions anymore. It's the sheer logistical friction and the corporate action nightmare.
Okay, unpack that.
Imagine Walter actually buys 500 individual stocks. He now has to track 500 different quarterly earnings reports. He has to manage the tax lots for 500 different positions.
That sounds miserable.
It is. When companies spin off divisions or issue special dividends or execute complex stock splits, Walter has to manually account for all of it. It requires an entire back office infrastructure. That is the first massive benefit of the pooled investment: convenience and professional administration. Walter gets one consolidated 1099 DIV form at the end of the year.
Just one single piece of paper instead of 500.
But exactly.
It's like a potluck dinner. You bring one dish, which is your capital, but you get to eat from a massive professionally curated buffet. You don't have to cook the whole feast. You don't have to wash all the pots and pans, but you still get a slice of the roast and a scoop of the potatoes.
I like that analogy.
Thanks. And that naturally leads to the second most heavily tested benefit, which is diversification. Even cautious Carl, who might only have $5,000 to his name, can buy into a mutual fund and instantly gain fractional exposure to hundreds of global equities.
And we have to be very, very precise about what diversification actually accomplishes. It mitigates unsystematic risk, which is business risk. So if one of those 500 companies goes completely bankrupt because their CEO committed fraud, Carl's portfolio barely feels a ripple. The loss is completely absorbed by the other 499 companies.
But I want to pause right here and ask you, the listener, a direct question. Think about Carl's highly diversified mutual fund holding 500 stocks. If the Federal Reserve unexpectedly hikes interest rates by 300 basis points and sends the entire global economy into a severe recession, does Carl lose money?
Take a second to think about it.
Yes, of course he does.
The distinction there is systematic risk versus unsystematic risk.
Hmm.
Diversification does not and cannot eliminate systematic risk, which is market risk.
Yeah, that's a huge exam trap.
If the ocean level drops, all the boats go down, regardless of how well-built Carl's specific boat is. The exam will repeatedly test your understanding of this boundary. Diversification protects you from a single bad apple. It does not protect you if the entire orchard catches fire.
Absolutely. Another major benefit on the buffet line is professional management. Instead of Walter trying to guess which semiconductor stock is going to dominate the next decade, a team of analysts and portfolio managers whose entire lives are dedicated to reading balance sheets makes that decision for him.
Though we should clarify that this applies primarily to actively managed funds.
Right. Good point.
Passively managed index funds simply mirror a benchmark. But even with an index fund, there is professional administration ensuring the tracking error remains incredibly low and the rebalancing happens efficiently behind the scenes.
What if impulsive Irene needs to leave the potluck early? She gets bored and wants her capital back today.
That is the benefit of liquidity. Open-end funds and ETFs generally provide daily liquidity. You can convert your investment back into cash very quickly without significantly moving the market price. Then you layer on the regulatory oversight. The Investment Company Act of 1940 is the bedrock of modern pooled investments.
I want to dig into the 1940 Act, because it's not just a random date. The historical context here is actually really fascinating. Back in the 1920s, before the Great Crash, you had these massive, unregulated investment trusts.
Oh, the Wild West.
Truly. Wall Street insiders would pool retail money, but then they would use that money to buy highly illiquid assets from their own friends at inflated prices. Or they would leverage the pools with insane amounts of debt. When 1929 hit, these trusts didn't just decline, they completely vaporized, taking retail investors down with them.
The abuse was just rampant. Self-dealing was basically the norm. So Congress stepped in with the Investment Company Act of 1940 to build a fortress around retail money.
And what did that fortress look like?
Well, the act mandated independent boards of directors. It strictly regulated the use of leverage and margin. It required that the actual underlying securities be held by a qualified third-party custodian, usually a major bank, so the fund manager couldn't just run off with the stock certificates in a suitcase.
Which was a real problem back then.
It was. And it also forced standardized, transparent financial reporting. When you buy a mutual fund today, you are buying into one of the most heavily regulated, historically battle-tested structures in global finance.
But every fortress has a maintenance cost. And that brings us to the risks and the trade-offs. We already established that you can't escape broad market risk. But what about the professional manager? We listed them as a benefit.
They are also a primary risk, management risk. You are paying a premium for someone else's brain. If that portfolio manager makes poor strategic allocations, your fund will underperform the benchmark. You might have been better off just buying a mindless automated index fund. Professional management is a double-edged sword.
Which leads directly to fee drag. Those analysts, the portfolio manager, the third-party custodian, the legal team ensuring 1940 Act compliance, none of those people work for free.
No, they don't.
Their salaries are paid directly out of the fund's assets. Over a 20-year time horizon, even a 1% annual fee can consume a massive, massive portion of Cautious Carl's potential compound growth.
And finally, the ultimate trade-off, lack of control. You have surrendered the steering wheel. You cannot tell the manager to hold on to a stock you like. You cannot tell them to avoid a sector you hate. And as we will explore deeply when we get to the tax section, you have absolutely zero control over when capital gains are realized. You have outsourced your tax timing to a complete stranger.
So the buffet is highly regulated, professionally cooked, and totally out of your control. But before we can even grab a plate, we have to pay the cover charge at the door. Let's talk about the ticket to ride, share classes, fees, and costs.
This is highly testable material.
Super highly testable. When Cautious Carl decides he wants to buy the, let's call it the Global Mega Cap Value Fund, his decision isn't over. He has to choose exactly which door he wants to walk through to enter that fund, Class A, Class B, or Class C.
And it is vital to understand that the underlying portfolio is identical.
Okay, stress that point.
Whether Carl buys an A share, a B share, or a C share, his money is going into the exact same pool of global mega cap stocks managed by the exact same guy. The only difference, the literal only difference, is the fee structure, how the broker gets paid, and when the fund company extracts its operational costs.
Let's start with Class A shares. I call Class A the upfront hit. Class A shares charge a front-end sales load. This is a percentage deducted from your capital at the exact moment you make the purchase.
The math here is straightforward, but the psychological hurdle is high. Let's say Cautious Carl invests $10,000 into a Class A mutual fund with a 5% front-end load. The broker immediately takes $500 as their commission. Only $9,500 actually crosses the threshold and gets invested into the market.
Carl pulls up his account on day one, and he is already down $500.
Exactly.
Carl's hyperventilating. He is a fee hater. He feels like he just got robbed before the race even started. Why on earth would any rational advisor recommend that Carl take a 5% loss on day one?
Because of the long game. Class A shares demand blood up front, but in exchange, they offer the lowest ongoing operating expenses of any share class. Their internal marketing and distribution fees, the 12B1 fees, are usually tiny, often 0.25% or less. If Carl is holding this fund for 20 years until retirement, paying $500 once and then enjoying rock bottom annual fees is mathematically far superior to paying a higher fee every single year. Class A shares are optimally suited for investors with a long time horizon and large amounts of capital.
Okay, so Carl holds his nose, takes the upfront hit, and settles in for a 2-decade hold. That makes sense. That is suitable. But what about impulsive Irene? She has $10,000 and she absolutely refuses to pay a $500 cover charge. She wants every single penny working in the market on day one.
Irene would likely be drawn to Class B shares. Class B shares are defined by a contingent deferred sales charge, or CDSC. There is zero front-end load. All $10,000 goes straight into the fund on day one.
But the fund company isn't running a charity, right? They have to pay the broker who sold Irene the fund. How do they recoup that money?
They get it on the back end, and they get it through elevated ongoing fees. The CDSC is a penalty fee you pay if you sell your shares too early. It is contingent upon when you redeem.
How does that penalty schedule work?
The schedule usually declines over time. For example, if Irene sells in year one, the fund company hits her with a 5% penalty. If she waits until year two, it drops to 4%. Year three, 3%. This declining schedule continues until, usually after 6 to 8 years, the CBSC drops to zero.
So Irene thinks, great, I just won't sell for 8 years and I'll avoid the front load and the back load. It's a free lunch.
And this is exactly where the suitability trap springs. While she's waiting out that 8-year clock, Class B shares are charging her significantly higher ongoing 12B1 fees than Class A shares would.
Right.
She is bleeding slightly more money every single day. The fund company is recovering the broker's commission slowly over time directly from the assets.
But there is a saving grace for Class B, right? A light at the end of the tunnel.
Yes. Once that CDSC schedule finally runs out, once she hits year 8 and the penalty drops to zero most boat, Class B shares automatically convert into Class A shares.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, her ongoing fees finally drop down to the cheap Class A level. Because of this conversion feature, Class B shares can be suitable for investors with intermediate to long horizons who don't have enough upfront cash to qualify for volume discounts.
I want to add a layer of industry reality here, just for context.
Sure.
If you look at the modern financial landscape, Class B shares are basically extinct.
They really are.
Very few fund families even offer them to new investors anymore because the regulatory scrutiny around them became too intense. Too many brokers were selling Class B shares to clients who actually had enough money to buy Class A shares at a massive discount. It was a huge suitability scandal. However, you must still know exactly how they work for the Series 66 because they are a prime vehicle for testing your understanding of time horizons.
That's exactly right. The exam loves testing the timeline of the CDSC and that conversion feature.
Okay, let's look at Class E shares, the never-ending subscription. Impulsive Irene doesn't want to wait 8 years for a CDSC to expire. She has the attention span of a goldfish.
Class E shares utilize a level load structure. They generally have no front-end load, and their CDSC is usually just 1%, and it typically disappears after a single year.
Irene is thrilled. No upfront hit, and she only gets penalized if she bails in the first 12 months. After year one, she is totally liquid with no exit fees. What is the catch?
The catch is a permanent maximum ongoing fee. Class C shares charge the absolute maximum allowable 12b1 fee every single year, forever.
Ouch.
And unlike Class B shares, Class C shares never ever convert to Class A. They are a permanent high fee subscription.
Let's run a direct comparison, because this is a classic exam scenario. Irene buys a Class C share because she likes the flexibility, but then she forgets about the account 10 years go by. What happens to her returns?
She gets absolutely decimated by fee drag. For 10 straight years, she has been paying maximum operational costs. If she had just paid the 5% front-end load for a Class A share a decade ago, her net return would be massively higher today.
So who are C shares actually for?
Class C shares are strictly for short-term investors, usually those with a horizon of 1 to 3 years. Putting a long-term investor into a Class C share is a blatant suitability violation.
We've mentioned this 12b1 fee several times now. We need to dissect it because it is heavily tested.
Yeah.
Where does this name come from and what is it actually paying for?
It is named after SEC Rule 12b1, which was adopted in 1980. The historical context is important here. In the late 70s, mutual funds were bleeding assets. People were pulling their money out. The mutual fund industry lobbied the SEC, arguing that if they could just use a small portion of the fund's own assets to pay for marketing and advertising, they could attract new investors.
Okay.
A larger asset base would theoretically create economies of scale, lowering the overall cost for everyone. The SEC agreed and passed Rule 12b1.
The idea was, let us spend the investors' money on billboards and broker commissions to attract more money, which will eventually make things cheaper for the current investors.
That was the theory. In practice, it just evolved into a permanent revenue stream to compensate brokers for ongoing client service and to pay for shelf space at major brokerage firms. The SEC eventually realized this and put strict caps on it.
Let's test the listener right now. What is the absolute maximum 12b1 fee a fund can charge its investors annually? Think about it.
Give them a second.
The answer is 1.00% of the fund's average net assets.
And you must know the exact breakdown of that 1.00%. The SEC dictates that a maximum of 0.75% can be used for distribution and marketing expenses. An additional 0.25% can be used for shareholder services, essentially paying the broker to answer the client's phone calls and provide ongoing advice. Combined, the absolute ceiling is 1.00%.
And what about no-load funds?
If a fund charges a 12b1 fee greater than 0.25%, it is legally prohibited from calling itself a no-load fund.
That is a phenomenal exam trap. If Cautious Carl sees a fund advertised as no-load, he thinks, great, zero fees.
Mm.
But that fund might still be charging him a 0.25% 12b1 fee every year. No-load just means no front or back-end sales charges. And a 12b1 fee that doesn't exceed 0.25%, it doesn't mean free.
Correct. Which brings us to the broader metric. The expense ratio. The 12b1 fee is just one slice of the pie. The expense ratio is the total annual operating expenses of the fund expressed as a percentage of its average net assets.
What goes into that pie?
Three main ingredients. First, the management fee. This is the big one. It pays the portfolio manager and their team of analysts. For a passive index fund, this might be 0.05%. For a complex, actively managed emerging markets fund, it might be 1.5%.
Right.
Second, you have the 12b1 fee we just discussed. Third, administrative costs. This pays the legal team, the accountants, the transfer agent who keeps track of who owns what, and the custodian bank holding the actual stocks. You add those three together, divide by the fund's total assets, and you get the expense ratio.
And what is strictly excluded from the expense ratio? If I pay a 5% front-end load to get into Class A, does that make the expense ratio higher for that year?
No. Sales loads are entirely excluded from the expense ratio. The expense ratio measures the ongoing cost of running the portfolio. A front-end load is a one-time cost of admission paid directly to the broker. They're completely separate calculations. Also excluded from the expense ratio are the actual brokerage commissions the fund pays when it buys and sells stocks internally.
All right, let's bring wealthy Walter into the mix.
Yeah.
Walter has a lot of money, and he hates leaving money on the table. He has $500,000 he wants to deploy into a mutual fund. He's a long-term investor, so you, his brilliant advisor, correctly recommend Class A shares.
Good recommendation.
Walter looks at the prospectus and sees a 5% front-end load. He does the math. 5% of $500,000 is $25,000.
Okay.
I am not paying a $25,000 cover charge just to get into the buffet.
And this is where you step in and show Walter the magic of breakpoints. Breakpoints are volume discounts on the front-end sales load. The more money you bring to the table, the lower the percentage the broker takes.
How steep are these discounts, really?
They can be massive. A typical breakpoint schedule might charge 5.0% for investments under $25,000. But if you invest $50,000, the load drops to 4.5%. At $100,000, it drops to 3.5%. At $250,000, it's 2.5%. And at Walter's level, $500,000, the load might drop all the way to 2.0%.
Wow.
So instead of paying $25,000, Walter pays $10,000. He just saved 15 grand simply because he had a large pile of capital. Many funds completely waive the sales load entirely if you invest over $1 million.
This is a critical regulatory zone. As an advisor, you have an affirmative legal obligation to ensure your clients receive the breakpoints they are entitled to. The exam will definitely test you on breakpoint sales.
A breakpoint sale is a massive violation. Imagine Walter only wanted to invest $99,000. The breakpoint for the next discount is at $100,000. If an advisor processes a trade for $99,000 without explicitly telling Walter that if he just finds $1,000 more, his overall fee will drop drastically, that advisor has committed a severe unethical act.
You're just trying to keep your commission high.
Exactly. You are intentionally keeping the client's investment just below the discount threshold so you can pocket a higher commission.
You will lose your license for that. And here is another highly talkable fact. Breakpoints applied only lie the Class A shares. Class B and Class C shares do not have volume discounts. You could invest $10 million into a Class C share, and you are still paying the maximum internal fees.
Which is another reason why putting a wealthy client into Class B or C shares is almost always a suitability violation. You are denying them the breakpoints they would receive in Class A.
But what if Walter's $500,000 isn't all sitting in his checking account today? What if he has $200,000 in his individual brokerage account, his wife has $200,000 in her IRA, and they have $100,000 in a custodial account for their daughter? Can he still get the discount?
Absolutely. The mutual fund industry offers a feature called rights of accumulation, or ROA. ROA allows an investor to combine the values of multiple accounts to reach a breakpoint threshold. It aggregates the capital.
Who counts for that?
It isn't just the investor's individual accounts. It explicitly includes accounts held by immediate family members, typically spouses and dependent children. As long as the money is being invested within the same overall fund family, like Vanguard or Fidelity.
And how is the value of those older accounts calculated?
Mm-hmm.
Let's say Walter bought $100,000 worth of the fund 10 years ago. It has grown massively and is now worth $250,000. Does the fund company use his original cost basis or the current value?
They use the current value. Most fund families use the current net asset value of the existing shares to calculate your eligibility for a new breakpoint. So Walter's past investment growth actually helps him secure steeper discounts on his new purchases today.
Okay, let's spin a more complicated scenario. Walter just sold a piece of commercial real estate. The buyer is paying him in installments over the next year. Walter has $50,000 in cash today. He knows with absolute certainty he is going to receive another $200,000 over the next 8 months, and he plans to invest all of it into this mutual fund. He wants the $250,000 breakpoint discount right now on his first $50,000 trade. Can he get a discount for money he doesn't even have yet?
Yes, through a mechanism called a letter of intent, or LOI. An LOI is a formal document signed by the investor stating their explicit intention to invest a certain amount of capital over a specified time frame to qualify for a breakpoint today.
I want to ask the listener another direct question. Grab your mental flashcards. How long is the time frame for an LOI?
Think carefully.
The exam will try to trick you by using annual terms. It's not 12 months. An LOI is valid for exactly 13 months.
13 months, and there is a secondary time feature. Let's say Walter actually bought $20,000 of the fund 2 months ago, paid the high sales load, and then today decides he wants to sign an LOI for $250,000. He can actually backdate the LOI up to 90 days to include those previous purchases toward his new goal.
13 months forward, 90 days backward. Lock those numbers in your brain. But let's look at the mechanics of the LOI, because this is where the exam gets really tricky. Walter signs the LOI for $250,000. He invests his first $50,000 today. The fund company gives him the lower 2.5% sales load instead of the 4.5% load he would normally pay for a 50 grand investment. Walter is happy.
Very happy.
But 10 months go by, and the real estate buyer defaults. Walter never gets the rest of his money. The 13 months expire, and Walter only ever invested that initial $50,000. What happens? Does the fund company sue him for breach of contract?
No. An LOI is a one-way street. It is not a binding legal contract on the investor. Walter is not required to invest the money, and he cannot be sued or fined for failing to meet the goal.
But the fund company isn't going to just let him walk away with an unearned discount. How do they mechanically protect themselves?
Escrowed shares. When Walter made his initial $50,000 purchase and received the unearned discount, the fund company didn't deposit all of those shares into his active account. They took a portion of his newly purchased shares and locked them in an escrow account.
A hostage situation.
Essentially, yeah. If Walter successfully completes the $250,000 investment within the 13 months, the fund company releases the escrowed shares into his active account and everyone is happy.
But if he fails?
If the 13 months expire and he fails to hit the target, the fund company retroactively recalculates his initial trade using the higher sales load he should have paid. To cover that difference, they simply liquidate the shares they were holding in escrow, pay the broker the missing commission, and release whatever tiny fraction is left to Walter. The fund always makes itself whole.
That is a brilliant mechanical fail-safe. Okay, so we've covered the fees, the classes, and the discounts. But let's talk about the actual underlying price of the investment. We are moving into pricing mechanics and liquidity. When Impulsive Irene decides she wants to buy or sell, how does the fund decide what one single share is actually worth?
This relies on a daily calculation called the net asset value, or NAV. The formula is foundational. It's total fund assets minus total fund liabilities divided by the total number of shares outstanding.
Let's visualize that. The assets are all the stocks and bonds the fund owns, plus any cash sitting in their accounts. The liabilities are the fees they owe to the manager, any money they owe to banks if they use leverage, and operational debts. You subtract the debts from the assets, and you are left with the pure net worth of the fund. Divide that by how many shares investors hold, and you have the NAV per share.
Exactly. For open-end mutual funds, this NAV is calculated exactly once per business day. Usually, this happens shortly after the New York Stock Exchange closes at 4:00 p.m. Eastern Time. The portfolio managers look at the closing prices of all 500 stocks in the portfolio, run the massive math equation, and publish the NAV. This NAV represents the fundamental value of the share. If you sell an open-end mutual fund, the price you receive is exactly the NAV.
But if you buy an open-end fund, you don't necessarily pay the NAV, you pay the public offering price, or POP.
Right. If you are buying a no-load fund, the POP equals the NAV. But if you are buying a Class A share with a front-end load, the POP equals the NAV plus the sales charge.
And here's the biggest mathematical trap on the Series 66. Listen very closely to how I phrase this. The sales load percentage is calculated based on the public offering price, not the net asset value.
This trips up candidates constantly because the math feels so counterintuitive.
Let me walk you through it. Cautious Carl wants to buy a fund. The NAV is calculated at exactly $20. The fund has a 5% front-end sales load. The intuitive but completely wrong way to do the math is to say 5% of $20 is $1. Therefore, the load is $1 and Carl pays a POP of $21. If you do that on the exam, you will fail the question.
The regulatory logic here is that the broker is paid a commission based on the total gross amount the client invests, the POP, not the net amount that ends up in the fund. So that 5% load means 5% of the final total price.
The correct formula to find the POP is NAV divided by, and put this in parentheses, 1 minus the sales load percentage. So in our example, it is $20 divided by 1 minus 0.05. That's $20 divided by 0.95. The answer is $21.05.
Yeah. Yep.
So the sales load is $1.05. If you take 5% of the final $21.05 POP, you get exactly $1.05.
Yeah.
You must calculate the percentage backwards from the total offering price.
It is a vital distinction. Now, let's look at the timing of when you actually get that price. This is a concept called forward pricing, and it is the defining operational characteristic of open-end mutual funds.
Impulsive Irene hates forward pricing. Let's say it's 11 a.m. on a Tuesday. The Federal Reserve makes a surprise announcement, and the stock market starts tanking rapidly. Irene panics. She logs into her account at 11:15 a.m. and smashes the sell button on her mutual fund. The market is down 2% at that moment. She thinks she just locked in her exit price before things get worse.
But she hasn't locked in anything. Because mutual funds only calculate their NAV once a day at 4:00 p.m., Irene's 11:15 a.m. order simply goes into a digital waiting room. She will receive whatever the NAV happens to be at 4 p.m. that afternoon. If the market continues to crash and is down 5% by the close, she gets the lower 4:00 p.m. price. Forward pricing means you always receive the next available calculated price.
What if she is busy and doesn't hit the sell button until 4:01 p.m.?
She missed the cutoff. Her order goes into the waiting room, and she will receive the NAV calculated at 4:00 p.m. on Wednesday, the next business day. She is locked into a 24-hour blind ride.
The SEC mandates forward pricing to prevent arbitrage. In the old days, before forward pricing, people would look at the market close, calculate the NAV themselves, and if they knew the Asian markets were crashing overnight, they would exploit the stale pricing. Forward pricing makes day trading an open-end mutual fund mathematically impossible. You are trading blind.
Which is exactly why open-end mutual funds always, without exception, transact at NAV or POP. There is no secondary market. You're buying directly from the fund company and selling directly back to the fund company. But that is not true for closed-end funds.
Let's pivot to closed-end funds because the rules change completely here. A closed-end fund does not continuously issue new shares. It acts much more like a traditional corporation. It does a one-time initial public offering to raise a set amount of capital, say $1 billion. It issues a fixed number of shares and then the doors close. The fund manager takes that $1 billion and invests it. But what happens to the shares?
Those fixed shares are listed on a public stock exchange, like the NYSE. From that point on, investors trade the shares among themselves. If cautious Carl wants to buy into the closed-end fund, he isn't giving his money to the fund manager. He is buying shares from impulsive Irene on the open exchange.
And because they trade on an exchange, their pricing mechanism is completely divorced from the rigid NAV formula of open-end funds.
Exactly. The price of a closed-end fund is dictated purely by supply and demand. The fund still calculates a daily NAV. They still add up the underlying assets and divide by the fixed shares, but the market price can wander far away from that NAV.
This creates premiums and discounts. If a closed-end fund is managed by a legendary superstar investor, people might be willing to pay $25 a share on the exchange, even if the underlying assets are only mathematically worth $20 a share. It is trading at a massive premium.
But more commonly, closed-end funds trade at a discount. If the fund has high internal fees or holds illiquid assets or just falls out of favor with investors, the market price might drop to $18 even though the NAV is $20. You are essentially buying the underlying assets for 90 cents on the dollar. The exam will relentlessly test this distinction. Open-end funds transact at NAV. Closed-end funds transact at the market price, which can be at a premium or a discount to NAV.
But wait a minute, we need to introduce the third major player, exchange-traded funds, or ETFs. Impulsive Irene loves ETFs. They trade on an exchange all day long. She can buy an S&P 500 ETF at 11:15 a.m. and sell it at 11:16 a.m. But if ETFs trade on an exchange based on supply and demand, just like closed-end funds, why don't ETFs have massive, persistent discounts? Why does an S&P 500 ETF always trade almost exactly at its underlying NAV?
This is one of the most brilliant architectural designs in modern financial history. The reason ETF prices stay tightly tethered to their NAV is due to a structural mechanism called the authorized participant, or AP.
This is a complex concept. Let's break it down with a tangible analogy. I want you to think of an ETF as a prepackaged fruit basket. It's supposed to cost $50 because the raw apples, bananas, and oranges inside it cost exactly $50 on the wholesale market. The NAV is $50. But suddenly there's a huge surge in public demand for these convenient fruit baskets. People start bidding up the price on the exchange, and soon the fruit basket is trading at $55. It is trading at a $5 premium.
Enter the authorized participant. An AP is a massive institutional market maker. They are like a giant wholesale grocery distributor. The AP sees this pricing anomaly. They see that retail investors are paying $55 for a basket of fruit that is only worth $50. The AP does not buy the expensive basket. Instead, they go into the open wholesale market and buy the raw apples, bananas, and oranges for $50.
So they gather the underlying assets.
Yes. The AP then takes those raw fruits, drives over to the ETF provider, and utilizes a special privilege. They hand the raw fruits to the ETF provider and say, I have the exact required ingredients. Trade me a brand new, fully packaged ETF fruit basket for these raw assets.
This is called the creation unit process. The ETF provider creates brand new shares out of thin air in exchange for the underlying stocks.
Exactly. The AP receives the newly minted ETF shares. They then immediately turn around and sell those shares on the open stock exchange to the retail investors for $55. The AP just locked in a $5 risk-free arbitrage profit.
But here is the magic part. Because the AP just flooded the market with brand new ETF shares, what happens to the supply? It goes up, and when supply goes up, the price drops. The AP's aggressive selling instantly crushes the market price of the ETF from $55 right back down to the $50 NAV.
And the mechanism works in reverse, too. If the ETF drops to a discount, say it's trading at $45 while the underlying fruits are still worth $50, the AP steps in again. They buy up the discounted ETF shares on the exchange for $45. They deliver those shares to the ETF provider, who destroys the ETF shares and hands the AP back the raw apples and bananas. The AP then sells the raw fruit on the wholesale market for $50, pocketing a $5 profit. By buying up the ETF shares, the AP removes supply from the market, driving the ETF price back up to $50.
This authorized participant arbitrage mechanism is constantly running in the background, executing thousands of times a second via algorithms. It acts like a gravitational tether, constantly snapping the ETF's market price back to its underlying NAV. Closed-end funds do not have this creation and redemption mechanism, which is exactly why they get stranded out in discount territory.
Which brings us perfectly to the concept of the liquidity spectrum. We've established how pricing works, but suitability requires us to understand how quickly a client can get their cash out without taking a massive haircut.
Let's build the spectrum, starting with high liquidity. If impulsive Irene needs her cash to buy a car tomorrow, where can we safely put her money?
High liquidity includes open-end mutual funds and ETFs. Open-end funds are highly liquid because the fund itself guarantees it will redeem your shares at that day's NAV. You never have to hunt for a buyer on an exchange. The fund is legally obligated to buy them back. ETFs are highly liquid because they trade on massive high-volume exchanges with APs constantly providing liquidity.
What about moderate liquidity?
Closed-end funds and unit investment trusts, or UITs. A candidate might assume a closed-end fund is highly liquid because it trades on the NYSE, but the trap is trading volume. Many closed-end funds are small and invest in niche esoteric assets like municipal bonds from a specific state. If Irene wants to sell a large block of a niche closed-end fund during a market panic, there simply might not be enough buyers. The bid-ask spread will widen drastically, and she will be forced to sell at a steep discount just to get out.
So exchange-traded does not automatically equal highly liquid. Good to know. What about low liquidity?
Now we are moving out of retail territory and into Wealthy Walter's domain. Hedge funds, and private equity. These vehicles explicitly restrict liquidity through lockup periods. A lockup period is a contractual clause stating you physically cannot withdraw your capital for a set time, often 1 to 2 years after your initial investment. The manager needs the stability to execute long-term illiquid strategies. Even after the lockup expires, hedge funds often only allow redemptions during specific quarterly or annual windows. If Walter puts his money in a hedge fund and has a liquidity crisis the next month, his money is totally trapped.
And what is the absolute bottom of Daryl? Very low liquidity.
Non-traded real estate investment trusts or non-traded REITs.
I call these the Roach Motels of the financial world. Easy to check your money in, incredibly difficult to check it out.
A standard REIT trades on an exchange and is highly liquid. But a non-traded REIT is completely illiquid. It is a massive pool of money used to buy physical commercial real estate office buildings, shopping malls. Because they don't trade on an exchange, there is no secondary market. You are entirely reliant on the REIT manager occasionally offering a share repurchase program, which they can suspend at any time. You might be completely stuck in a non-traded REIT for 10 years until they finally liquidate the portfolio. The exam will test your ability to spot the word non-traded and instantly flag it as unsuitable for anyone who might need access to their cash.
Okay, we have survived the fees, we understand the pricing algorithms, and we know our liquidity limits. But now we have to talk about the silent killer of compounding wealth, the most complex and heavily tested section of pooled investments. Taxes, the phantom menace.
Mm-hmm.
Wealthy Walter's accountant is about to have a heart attack.
To understand how a mutual fund is taxed, you first have to understand subchapter M of the Internal Revenue Code.
Let's lay the groundwork. Normally, if a corporation makes a profit, it pays a corporate income tax. Then, if it distributes that profit to its shareholders as a dividend, the shareholders pay tax on it again. Double taxation. Mutual funds hold stocks that pay dividends, and they sell stocks for capital gains. If a mutual fund was taxed like a regular corporation, the returns would be completely destroyed by double taxation.
Exactly. So the industry created a carve-out. If a mutual fund structures itself to comply with Subchapter M, it qualifies as a regulated investment company, or RIC. This grants the fund conduit or pass-through tax status.
What is the golden rule they have to follow to get that special status?
The 90% rule. To avoid entity-level taxation, the fund must distribute at least 90% of its net investment income, meaning dividends and interest, and its net realized capital gains to its shareholders every single year. If they pass at least 90% of the profits through to the investors, the fund itself pays zero taxes on the distributed amount. It acts merely as a conduit, a pipeline, passing the tax burden directly to the shareholders.
Most funds distribute close to 100%, just to be safe. And this pipeline structure is exactly what creates the phantom gain exam nightmare we talked about in the opening hook. Let's revisit Cautious Carl's horror story with extreme detail, because you will absolutely see this scenario on the exam.
It is the ultimate test of understanding how control and taxation intersect in a mutual fund.
Let's build the timeline. 10 years ago, the portfolio manager of the Global Tech Fund bought a massive block of a little startup company for $10 a share. Over the next decade, that company explodes in value. The stock goes to $200 a share. Inside the mutual fund, there is now a massive, unrealized profit, an embedded gain. No taxes are owed yet because the manager hasn't sold the stock.
The fund has a huge embedded tax liability. It's a ticking time bomb of capital gains waiting to be triggered.
Now, cut to present day. It's November 1st. Cautious Carl decides he wants exposure to the tech sector. He buys $10,000 worth of the Global Tech Fund. His timing is terrible. Over the next 3 weeks, the tech sector corrects and the fund's overall NAV drops by 5%. Carl's $10,000 investment is now only worth $9,500. He is losing money.
But the portfolio manager, looking at the macroeconomic landscape, decides that the massive tech stock they bought 10 years ago has finally peaked. They decide to sell the entire position to lock in the profits and protect the fund.
They sell the stock for $200 a share. They just realized a 1,900% profit. And because the 90% rule is subchapter M, the fund cannot keep that cash inside the portfolio. They must distribute those capital gains to the shareholders before the end of the year.
So in December, the fund declares a massive capital gains distribution. The cash is pushed out of the fund and into the accounts of every single person who currently owns a share.
And this is where Carl's brain breaks. Carl gets a 1099 DIV form in the mail from the IRS saying he owes taxes on thousands of dollars of capital gains. Carl calls his advisor screaming. I just got here. I didn't own the fund during that 10-year run-up, and my shares have actually gone down in value since I bought them. How can I owe taxes on a profit I didn't participate in?
It feels incredibly unjust, but it is mechanically correct. The IRS does not care when Carl arrived at the potluck dinner. When a fund distributes a capital gain, it is distributed evenly to all current shareholders of record on the distribution date. Carl is paying taxes on a decade of growth that he wasn't around to enjoy. This is the phantom gain. He is absorbing the embedded tax liability of the fund.
And the exam traps go even deeper here. Let's talk about holding periods. Carl has only owned the mutual fund for 6 weeks. Does he pay the high short-term capital gains tax rate or the lower long-term capital gains tax rate on this distribution?
Another massive exam trap. The tax classification of the distribution is based entirely on the F-on-DS holding period, not the investor's holding period. Because the mutual fund held the underlying stock for 10 years before selling it, it is a long-term capital gain. It passes through the conduit as a long-term gain. It does not matter that Carl only held the mutual fund for 6 weeks. The character of the gain belongs to the fund.
Let's add one more layer of misery for Carl. Let's say he set up his account to automatically reinvest all dividends and capital gains directly back into the fund to buy more shares. He never even saw the cash hit his checking account. Doesn't that reinvestment defer the tax liability until he finally sells the mutual fund years later?
Absolutely not. This is heavily tested. Reinvesting distributions does not defer the tax. Under IRS rules, this is considered constructive receipt. The fund made the money available to you, you just chose to use it to buy more shares. The distribution is fully taxable in the year it is distributed, regardless of whether you take the cash or automatically reinvest it. The IRS wants its cut right now.
To recap Carl's nightmare, he inherited someone else's 10-year gain. He got taxed on it, despite his personal position losing value. He got taxed immediately, even though he reinvested the cash. And the tax rate was dictated by the manager's timeline, not his own. This is what we mean when we say a mutual fund requires you to surrender control of your tax timing.
Which is why wealthy Walter's accountant is begging him to look at ETFs. Impulsive Irene trades ETFs because they are liquid, but Walter should be trading ETFs because they are incredibly tax efficient.
Is it true that ETFs don't have phantom gains? Are they tax-free?
Let's clarify the terminology. ETFs are highly tax efficient. They are not tax-free. They still pass through regular dividends, which are taxable just like a mutual fund, but they are vastly superior at avoiding the distribution of internal capital gains. In a given year, 40 to 50% of mutual funds might distribute a taxable capital gain. Less than 5% of ETFs will do the same.
How is that mechanically possible? If an ETF manager decides to sell a stock, doesn't that trigger a gain?
It does if they sell it for cash. But remember our authorized participant, the grocery distributor.
Right, the AP arbitrage mechanism.
The creation and redemption process with the AP is executed via in-kind transfers. If a massive block of retail investors decides to sell their ETF shares, the ETF provider needs to shrink the fund. In a mutual fund, the manager would have to sell underlying stocks for cash to pay those exiting investors, triggering massive capital gains for everyone left behind in the fund.
The remaining investors get stuck with the tax bill for the people who left.
Exactly. But an ETF doesn't sell stocks for cash. The ETF provider takes a basket of the underlying highly appreciated stock and hands the actual shares directly to the AP in exchange for retiring ETF shares. Because no cash actually changed hands inside the fund, it was an exchange of securities and in-kind transfer, the IRS rules state that no taxable capital event was triggered for the fund.
That is a phenomenal loophole.
It is a massive structural advantage. Furthermore, the ETF manager can cherry-pick exactly which tax lots of stock they hand to the AP. They always hand over the shares with the lowest cost basis, the ones with the biggest embedded gains. This allows the ETF to constantly flush its massive unrealized capital gains out of the portfolio without ever triggering a taxable event for Walter, who is just sitting there holding the ETF long term.
That in-kind redemption mechanism is the secret sauce of the modern ETF industry.
All right, we have navigated the fees, the pricing, the liquidity, and the treacherous tax traps. We are rounding the final corner into Section 5. The scorecard, relative comparisons and benchmarks. We've paid the broker, we've paid the IRS. The last step before we confidently recommend a pooled investment to a client is evaluating the portfolio manager. Was this active manager actually any good? Did they earn their management fee?
And to answer that, you have to use the correct measuring stick. A return number in a vacuum is completely meaningless. If a manager gets you a 12% return in a year, is that a good performance or a bad performance? You have absolutely no idea until you look at the benchmark. The golden rule of suitability and performance tracking is that you must match the benchmark to the fund's specific investment style.
I see this mistake all the time with retail investors.
Time for a pattern interrupt. I'm going to do my best impression of Wealthy Walter bragging at the country club after a few drinks. Here we go. Well, my friends, my actively managed high-yield municipal bond fund returned a staggering 8% this year. I absolutely crushed the market. The S&P 500 only did 6%. My portfolio manager is an absolute genius. And I'm a genius for hiring him.
I have had that exact conversation with clients. Walter, you cannot compare a tax-exempt municipal bond fund to a large cap equity index. That is a completely meaningless comparison. It's like comparing a marathon runner's time to a drag racing car. The S&P 500 measures the largest 500 equities in the U.S. stock market. Your bond fund invests in local government debt. They have entirely different risk profiles, different economic drivers, and different volatility metrics.
So what should Walter be comparing his S&P 500 crushing bond fund to?
To measure his manager's actual skill, he needs to compare it to a relevant bond benchmark, like the Bloomberg U.S. Aggregate Bond Index or a specific municipal bond index. If his municipal bond fund did 8%, but the municipal bond benchmark did 10%, his genius manager actually severely underperformed the asset class and destroyed value relative to a passive alternative. He paid a premium management fee to lose to the market.
The exam will heavily test your knowledge of which benchmark goes with which type of fund. You need to know the major indexes and exactly what they track. Let's hit them. First, the big one, the S&P 500.
The Standard & Poor's 500 tracks 500 of the largest U.S. publicly traded companies, but the key testable point is how it is weighted. The S&P 500 is market capitalization weighted. This means the larger the total value of the company, the more influence it has on the index's daily movement. If Apple, which is worth trillions, moves 2%, it impacts the S&P 500 massively more than if a company worth only $10 billion moves 2%. It reflects the actual total economic footprint of the market.
Next, the grandfather of them all. The Dow Jones Industrial Average, or DJIA.
The Dow tracks just 30 massive blue chip U.S. companies, but here is The major exam trap. You must understand how the Dow is constructed. The Dow is price-weighted, not market cap-weighted.
We need to explain why, because it sounds ridiculous in a modern context.
It is a historical quirk. Back in 1896, when Charles Dow created the index, there were no computers. He had to calculate the market average by hand every afternoon for the Wall Street Journal. The only feasible way to do the math was to literally take the per share price of the stocks, add them all up, and divide by the number of stocks.
So a stock with a $400 share price influences the Dow vastly more than a stock with a $20 share price, regardless of which company is actually larger in total market capitalization. A company could be worth $50 billion, but if its share price is $500, it dominates a company worth $500 billion whose share price is only $50.
It is an archaic system, but it is still one of the most quoted indexes in the world. The exam will definitely test you on this. DJIA equals price weighted. S&P 500 equals cap weighted.
What if cautious Carl wants to measure his small cap growth fund? He shouldn't use the Dow.
He would use the Russell 2000. That is the standard industry benchmark for small cap U.S. stocks. It tracks 2,000 smaller companies.
And the NASDAQ composite.
Tracks all the stocks listed on the NASDAQ exchange. It is extremely tech heavy, so it is the appropriate benchmark for a technology sector fund.
What if wealthy Walter wants to diversify globally?
For international developed markets, places like Japan, the UK, Germany, the standard benchmark is the MSCI EAFE index. That stands for Europe, Australasia, and Far East. It explicitly excludes the U.S. and Canada.
Finally, let's look closer at the bond side. The Bloomberg U.S. Aggregate Bond Index.
This is the broad measuring stick for the U.S. bond market. It tracks investment-grade, fixed-rate bonds, treasuries, highly rated corporate bonds, mortgage-backed securities. But there is a massive exam trap here. The U.S. Aggregate Bond Index does not include high-yield or junk bonds. It is strictly investment-grade. If you have a high-yield bond fund, you cannot compare it to the aggregate index.
Okay, so we've matched the benchmark perfectly. Let's run a final scenario. Cautious Carl finds an actively managed small cap mutual fund. He compares it to the Russell 2000. He pulls up the 10-year chart. The fund has utterly crushed the Russell 2000 benchmark for 10 years straight. The performance line goes up and to the right beautifully. The expense ratio is completely reasonable. Carl is ready to pour his retirement savings into it. It looks like a sure thing. But what if I told you the portfolio manager who ran the fund for those 10 flawless years just quit last month to start his own private hedge fund, and a brand new, untested 28-year-old manager took over the portfolio yesterday?
Then Carl needs to slam the brakes immediately. This brings us to the concept of manager tenure. You always see the disclaimer, past performance is no guarantee of future results. That is a legal requirement. But from a practical analysis standpoint, past performance is utterly, completely useless if the architect of that performance is no longer in the building.
The track record belongs to the human, not the mutual fund ticker symbol.
Exactly. A recent manager change is a massive red flag that makes historical returns irrelevant. If a fund has a stellar 10-year track record but a 6-month manager tenure, those past returns tell you absolutely nothing about what the new manager will do during the next market crisis. Manager tenure dictates how much weight you can actually assign to the historical performance data.
Wow. We have covered an immense amount of ground today.
Yeah.
From the 1940 Act and the buffet lines, the diversification, through the punishing schedules of Class B and C shares, into the arbitrage magic of ETFs, the phantom nightmares of subchapter M, and the historical quirks of Charles Dow. Instead of just reading off a list of facts, I want to synthesize everything we've learned by looking at the final portfolios of our 3 crash test dummies. If you were their Series 66 advisor and you applied all these rules correctly, where do they end up?
Let's start with cautious Carl. Carl is terrified of risk, hates fees, but has a 20-year horizon.
A perfectly suitable portfolio for Carl would lean heavily into Class A share mutual funds. He pays the upfront load once, swallows his pride, and benefits from 20 years of rock-bottom 12b1 fees. We keep him in highly diversified large-cap funds to mitigate unsystematic business risk, but we repeatedly counsel him that he's still exposed to systematic market risk. When December rolls around, we prepare him mentally for the phantom capital gains distribution so he doesn't panic.
Now, impulsive Irene. She has a short horizon, demands extreme liquidity, and hates lockups.
Irene belongs in exchange-traded funds. ETFs trade intraday, giving her the immediate liquidity she demands. Because of the AP arbitrage mechanism, she knows she's trading very close to the actual NAV, avoiding the premiums and discounts of closed-end funds. Furthermore, the in-kind redemption structure of the ETF shields her from the phantom capital gains that plague mutual funds. We absolutely keep her out of classy mutual funds so she doesn't accidentally bleed to death on maximum ongoing fees, and we run far away from non-traded REITs or hedge funds that would lock up her capital.
And finally, wealthy Walter. Huge capital, terrible at math, oblivious to taxes.
Walter's portfolio is an exercise in complex cost reduction. We utilize letters of intent stretching over 13 months to secure him massive breakpoints on Class A shares. We actively monitor his family's accounts to ensure we are applying rights of accumulation, capturing discounts using the appreciated NAV of his older investments. And because he is in a massive tax bracket, we aggressively pivot his taxable accounts toward highly tax-efficient ETFs while keeping his actively managed high-turnover mutual funds sheltered inside tax-advantaged retirement accounts to neutralize the phantom gain threat.
If you can execute those three strategies, you understand the characteristics of pooled investments at a level that will allow you to crush the Series 66.
Amazing. Before we sign off, I want to leave you, the listener, with a provocative final thought. Something to chew on as you continue your studies. We just spent a lot of time talking about evaluating the human portfolio manager, checking their tenure, analyzing their active strategy, and comparing them to benchmarks.
But the reality of modern finance is that passively managed index funds and algorithmic AI-driven ETFs are completely taking over the market. We are actively moving trillions of dollars out of human hands and into automated benchmark trackers, effectively eliminating management risk entirely. The human element is fading.
And it raises a really important, almost existential question for the financial markets. If everyone in the world realizes that active managers usually underperform, and everyone just automatically buys the exact same passive S&P 500 index fund, nobody is actually out there analyzing individual companies anymore. Nobody is reading the balance sheets to find true value or expose fraud. Are we slowly destroying the very market efficiency that makes these benchmarks reliable in the first place? If every single passenger is in the back of the bus buying passive index funds, who is actually driving the bus?
It is the ultimate paradox of passive investing. The passive strategy only works if there are enough active managers out there setting the correct prices. If everyone becomes passive, the price discovery mechanism breaks down completely.
Something to mull over as you dive back into your textbooks. Keep crushing your Series 66 prep. You now understand the deep why behind pooled investments. When you see Irene, Carl, and Walter's profiles on that exam screen, you'll know exactly how to protect them and your license. Best of luck on exam day. You've got this.